Well, Brother Art's passing our lesson guide out for this morning. Let's head in our Bibles to Revelation 9. Revelation 9, we spent a little time introducing this chapter last Sunday as we finished looking at the first four trumpet judgments, and then we learned about the three woe judgments that we'll start looking at again today. So, Revelation 9, where these trumpet judgments continue from chapter 8. So the very first thing that you see there in your lesson guide is that the first two woes actually correspond with the fifth and sixth trumpets that we come to here in chapter 9. So if you look at verse, and remember when the Bible was written, we didn't have all the chapter divisions or the verse divisions, so there would not have been a chapter 8, verse 13, there wouldn't have been a chapter 9, verse 1. It would have just flowed one, from one to the other. So kind of verse 13 flows with and goes into chapter 9, but look at that verse again. John says, "And I beheld and heard." That is something that you find frequently throughout, where John not only sees but hears something. And in this case, he sees and hears an eagle. That's where a lot of the, probably the majority of Greek manuscripts have it. The King James found a few that just said angel. Either way, the effect is the same. This eagle or angel is flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe." And that introduces the three woes that are going to be coming up in these last three trumpet judgments. And it's to the inhabitants of the earth. If you remember, that is sort of an official designation of unbelievers in the book of Revelation. We find it several times, really many times, all throughout the book. But these inhabitants of the earth are going to experience those woes by reason of the other voices, the other sounds of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound. So again, the first two woes we come to here in chapter 9, and they correspond with the fifth and sixth trumpets. Now also, not only did we consider the woes last Sunday, but we also learned that the fifth and sixth trumpets follow a certain pattern, a pattern that we find in the Old Testament prophecy of Joel. And if you remember, that was a pattern. We just briefly looked at it. Maybe you took that as some of your homework to read through the book of Joel throughout the week. But if you remember, in the book of Joel, we see a pattern where there's, first of all, an invasion by an army of locusts, and then a second invasion by an army of men. And Joel chapter 1 talks about that locust invasion, which was probably a real historical event back in the time of Judah. And then, of course, we have this invasion by an army of men, which also was real and historical, took place when the Babylonians came in and flooded country of Judah. And whereas locusts would leave no green thing, they would eat as much as they could, the Babylonians, everything they went to was, they were burning things. And so we kind of see those differences there in Joel. But one of the things that we need to remember when we think about these Old Testament patterns, another word that is often used is allusion, not illusion, but allusion with an A. Basically, there's a lot of places in the book of Revelation that allude to and point back to places in the Old Testament. So when we think about this pattern between Joel and Revelation chapter 9, Joel is not describing what is going on here in Revelation. It's not a prophecy of what's taking place here in chapter 9, but instead, it's a pattern. It provides a pattern of what John sees and hears in this part of his vision of Revelation. And so as a pattern, it teaches us how to interpret and how to understand better what's going on in chapter 9, even though it's not talking about the exact same thing. So God intends for both John and his audience, which includes us today, to understand what is going on here in Revelation in light of what was going on there in Joel. And so even though it's not the exact same thing, yet it provides a pattern for us to really understand a little bit more about what's going on here in chapter 9. Now, if you remember, this is actually something that we find in other places in Revelation. If you remember, when we looked at the four seals of Revelation chapter 6, it also followed a pattern that we find in the Old Testament, and that pattern is found in Zechariah chapter 1, where God shows to Zechariah a vision of spiritual horses. Not just one single horse with one single horse rider, but multiple horses, but they are of different colors. and they're coming into this world, and they roam this earth in order to bring about God's judgment. And so the pattern of Zechariah is something that we found also in Revelation 6. Revelation and Zechariah are not talking about the same thing. Zechariah is not prophesying what happens in Revelation, but rather they share similar pictures and patterns which can help us understand more about what's going on here in Revelation. If you remember back when we looked at chapter 6, just like the horses in Zechariah kept on roaming the earth, that's what happens in Revelation. So even though the seals have all been opened and the scroll has been opened, yet those four horsemen and those four horses of different colors have not been recalled. They are still roaming and running through the earth even as these trumpet judgments are going on, okay? Because they are the ones, they are the forces, the spiritual forces that God has put into place to continue this work of devastation, of conflict, of conquest, of bringing into famine, and of course all of the death and mayhem that takes place. And as we looked at, when we looked at those seals, those horsemen bring about everything that Jesus said would happen during the period of time between his return to heaven and his return from heaven. That's the age in which we live. And at the very end of that age is the Great Tribulation. So these are the wars and rumors of wars, of all the famines and pestilences and earthquakes that Jesus described in Matthew 24. And remember, that was just the beginning of sorrows when Jesus was heading back to heaven. And those sorrows will continue to increase and intensify until Jesus comes back from heaven. So even though, again, all seven seals of the scroll have been opened, and now we're in the middle of looking at that scroll and those trumpet judgments, those four horsemen have not been recalled. And those martyrs that are crying out to the Lord, they're also continuing to be killed throughout this age. And so those horsemen continue. So that's just one way that you can see the pattern of Zechariah in Revelation chapter 6, because they've never been recalled. They're still out there doing their work of mayhem. This is also something that we found in the first interlude that we came to in chapter 7. So whereas the four seals point back to Zechariah chapter 1, the first interlude, you know, where we meet the 144,000 and that great multitude, it actually follows the pattern of Ezekiel chapter 9. So another passage it alludes to, it points back to. So if you really want to know what's going on in chapter 7 of Revelation, you got to go back to Ezekiel 9 and understand what's going on there. If you remember, the faithful remnant of Jerusalem in Ezekiel were actually given a mark by God on their foreheads that was a spiritual mark, an invisible mark. And it set them apart from all of the others so that they would not experience God's judgment when the Babylonians came in. And so that was something that took place all the way back in Ezekiel chapter 9. Now again, Ezekiel and Revelation aren't talking about the same thing. That was historic. This is something that is yet future, or some say is ongoing now. But they do also share similar pictures and patterns that we can apply to John's vision. I think one of those things that we can apply is that the seals of God's servants in Revelation is also a spiritual seal. It's probably not going to be something that is visible, but rather something that God indicates to his people in a spiritual way that they belong to him. It is going to be counterfeited, of course, by the beast later on, but it's to reassure God's people that no matter what you face during the period of the Great Tribulation, your soul is sealed and safe. And so you can get that from Ezekiel chapter 9. Well, that's what we find here with these spiritual invasions that we find in the fifth and sixth trumpets of Revelation 9. Again, Joel and Revelation are not talking about the same thing, but they share similar pictures and patterns that help us to know help us to understand better what's going on in Revelation. So with that in mind, and we think back again to that situation there in Joel, let's read about that first woe, which is also the fifth trumpet judgment in these first 12 verses of chapter 9. Where we read, the fifth angel sounded, or the fifth angel trumpeted. And of course he had that trumpet that he sounded. And I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and upon them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. And to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months. And their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. And in those days shall men seek death, and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle, and on their heads were, as it were, crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men, and they had hair as the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions. And they had breastplates, as it were breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle, and they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails. And their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. One woe is past, and behold, there come two woes more hereafter. So again, the first woe corresponds with a fifth trumpet judgment. And as we just read, there's clearly something different going on when this trumpet is sounded than the previous four. Obviously, there's a big difference between what we found here in chapter 9 and what we read in chapter 8. And it's not just because the first four trumpets primarily deal with the world of nature, which we looked at, while these two trumpet judgments primarily deal with the world of men. I mean, that certainly is the case. That is true. But as the beginning of the woe judgments, the judgments of chapter 9 are much greater in severity than what we found in chapter 8. Obviously, in chapter 8, it deals with certain sectors and sections all throughout the world. But here now we find it affecting men in an untold scale. And so there seems to be a transition not just between the world of nature and the world of men. There also seems to be a transition from things that could be seen or at least explained away in natural terms as natural events, and we saw this last time, or really all throughout chapter 8, where you know there might be some natural counterparts to the supernatural judgments. You know, maybe there's a volcano involved, or a meteor involved, or you know, a comet involved, or anything like that. So they could be explained away in natural terms. But now when we come to chapter 9, there are things and events that are clearly supernatural and spiritual in nature. You can't explain it away in some natural terms. Now, we already got a hint of this transition when we looked at the fourth trumpet, which we were told in verse 12 of chapter 8. Remember when the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, and the picture that we have there in the text is that those objects themselves were changed in some way. The sun was smitten, the moon was smitten, and the third part of the stars were smitten. And so they were changed in some way so that their light could not shine and did not shine in a way that we're familiar with. So they shined in a way that is contrary to the laws of nature that as we know it. So clearly there's a shift already from something that is natural or could be explained in natural terms into something that is more supernatural. And now we come into something that is even more spiritual. Something that is really, you can't explain it in natural terms at all. So that's what we find here in the fifth trumpet. The transition continues from the natural to the supernatural, and then from the supernatural to the spiritual world, to spiritual events, and that will become more and more apparent before the return of the Lord. And this ought to remind us as we move into some of the perhaps most disturbing sections of Revelation, especially when we think about these trumpet judgments, is that the spiritual worlds that are above us and below us are really not as far away as they seem. The spiritual worlds, the spiritual realm, the spiritual things above us and below us are not as far away as they seem. In fact, if you remember all the way back in chapter 4, verse 1, just as the visions are starting to come, right? So chapter 1, Jesus shows himself to John. And then chapters 2 and 3, Jesus gives John messages to the seven churches. And then in chapter 4, what happens? Well, the very first verse in chapter 4, verse 1, it says, a door was opened where? In heaven for John. And that door was the door through which God enabled him to come up hither so that he might show him things which must be hereafter. And certainly all of the things that we find in chapter 6 and here in chapter 8 and 9 are future for John. Some of it's past for us, and some of it's still future for us. But from John's perspective, it was all things that were yet future. Remember, he received this just at the very end of the first century. And so these were all things that were going to happen in his lifetime and even beyond his lifetime. And so the door to heaven was open. So John was able to see spiritual and heavenly things, which he then conveys to us in this book the best way that he can. And of course, the best way that he tells us about what's going to happen is in terms of Scripture. How much do we find of biblical language and biblical allusions and biblical patterns and biblical pictures all throughout the book of Revelation? But that was true for John then. But what we have here in chapter 9 is something that will be true for the entire world. And that is when what we could call a door to hell will also be opened, so that some of the spiritual residents there would be unleashed into the world of men. So we remember, the spiritual world is not that far from us in this world. It is like just a doorway to heaven or a doorway to hell. I think Joseph Seitz said it well when he wrote these words. He says, it appears then that hell and hell torments are not the mere fictions which some have pronounced them to be. Neither are they as remote from this present world as men often dream. There is a fiery abyss with myriads of evil beings in it, malignant and horrible. And there is but a door between the world, this world, and that. Heaven is just as near, but heaven is above, and hell is beneath. Mortal man and his world lie between two mighty opposite spiritual spheres. And so as we approach this first woe and this fifth judgment, it really is a solemn thing to think that even though John was able to enter that doorway into heaven, here we have a doorway to hell itself, and many of the residents that are there will actually invade this world and bring about catastrophe like we've never seen before. These are God's judgments. They continue to increase in severity, and what the warnings were back in the first four, now we find what he's warning about. Because the devil himself wants to afflict even those that worship him. And so we need to keep all this in mind as we turn now to really what we've seen in all of the judgments. And so we see it here in the fifth judgment as well. And that is the components of the fifth trumpet. We're really going to focus on verse 1 because, again, it lays the foundation for what is yet to come in these verses. But when we think about the components of the fifth trumpet, verse 1, it says, the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth. To him was given the key of the bottomless pit. So there are three components that we find in this one verse. The first is a star, the second is a key, and then the third is the bottomless pit. And we're going to look at those in that order. So in words that are reminiscent of the third trumpet judgment, in fact, keep your finger here. Look back at verse 10 of chapter 8, where we find that a third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. And so, you know, a lot of people will look at chapter 8, verse 10, and look at chapter 9, verse 1, and say, well, there's a lot of similarities. And yes, there is at least some similarities in that you have a star, and you have that star being fallen in some way. So, in words that are reminiscent, that remind us of that third trumpet judgment, we're first told about that star. A star that John saw fall from heaven unto the earth. Again, verse 10 of chapter 8, there fell a great star from heaven. And so that's one of the comparisons there. So under both of these trumpet judgments, we find a star that falls. We find a star that falls. Now that has led some to either believe that both trumpet judgments are describing the same thing, or at least they need to be understood in the same way. So yeah, there are some that would actually look at each one of these trumpet judgments as really describing an intensification of the same thing. One writer that I read, and I didn't write it down on my list, so I'm just kind of doing this from memory, was he said it's basically different degrees of delusion and deception in the world. So when you talk about the first trumpet judgment, all the way down through the seventh trumpet judgment, every single one of those just shows an intensification of deception by the devil into this world to lead them astray from the Lord. And so they would see chapter 9, verse 1 as being the same thing to some extent as chapter 8, verse 10. But even if they don't see it as the same way, there are some who say that they need to be understood the same way. So if you take the star in chapter 8 to be a literal object, which is what I consider it to be, or at least some kind of astronomical object. Remember, it wasn't stars back in ancient days were not just the glowing stars in heaven that we see. It could have been anything that was bright in appearance in the sky. It could have been a planet. It could have been a comet. It could have been a meteor. And so when we, you know, if you take that star in chapter 8 to be a literal object, then you need to take the star in chapter 9, verse 1 in the same way. So they would say, if you're going to take the one literal, you have to take the other literal. Or if you take the star in chapter 9 as a symbol for a spiritual being, like a fallen angel, like the devil, again, which, you know, I'll tell you here, I kind of take it to be, then you also need to do the same thing with the star in chapter 8. So either they're both literal or they're both symbolic of some kind of spiritual being. And there are some who would say that if you take one way and the other way, you will be, and the key word is inconsistent in your interpretation of these trumpet judgments. I read that in a couple of commentaries. And usually they would say if you're inconsistent there, you're going to be inconsistent with your interpretation of all of the book of Revelation. I don't think that's a valid concern. Because if you take the text of Revelation just like it's given, and I hope that's kind of been our approach. We're looking at the book of Revelation just to see how it's given, but you're trying to understand it in its most normal and natural sense. And usually when you look at the word literal, when you take something literally, that's usually what people mean when they look at the scripture. I want to take the Bible in its normal, natural sense. Because are there symbols in scripture? Absolutely. We've come across many of them already in the book of Revelation. And some of them are even defined for us, right? So When Jesus is there holding the seven stars of the seven churches in his right hand, he even says himself that those stars represent the angels, the messengers of those seven churches. So those stars are not the messengers, they represent the messengers. And so even in Revelation, we know there are symbols. We know that there are signs. There are things that portray and represent other things. But we also know in Scripture there are places that are not symbolic. You know, we've looked at this, how one of the patterns that we find in chapter 8 and 9 goes back all the way to the Exodus of Egypt. When you think about all the different kinds of plagues that God used to bring his people out of Egypt, and a lot of those same plagues are found in chapters 8 and chapter 9. We talked about the water turning into blood. We talked about, you know, the darkness in the world. We're talking about the locusts here and even the death of many different people. Well, back in Exodus, they weren't just symbols. They were real. And so if you come to Scripture and you try to take it in its normal, natural sense, there are going to be times where things are symbolic. There are times when things are going to be what we would consider literal. You know, and any author is free to do this, right? Any writer. You know, Colson did some writing yesterday, I think. And I know that when he writes books, a lot of those books, a lot of those things that he uses are meant to portray things. There are symbols in what he says. But not everything is a symbol. Like when you go through the book of Revelation, one of the first characters that you come to is John. Is John a real person or is John meant to symbolize somebody? Well, probably both, but he was a real person. He's not just some symbol or symbolic figure. So in Revelation, there are symbols and there are normal, literal things. So I don't think it's inconsistent to see in verse 10 of chapter 8 the fallen angel as one thing, and then here in chapter 9, a fallen angel as, or a fallen star as another. I meant fallen star. And this simply means that when the text expresses things in a way that are clearly meant to be symbolic, you take them that way. Otherwise, you take them in their normal, natural sense, unless there are clues. And Revelation are full of clues that indicate that something else is going on. In fact, when you in this text, in chapter 9, When you go to looking at what these locusts look like in verse 7 and all the way through verse 11, there's a clue that there's a lot of symbolism here, okay? And those are the words like or as, like or as, like or as. That's one of the clues when you come to the book of Revelation that that is something that is symbolic. It's meaning something. For example, the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle. Were they horses prepared unto battle? No, they were locusts that looked something like it. And you can go on. Also, when you come to the verse 8, and we'll look at that when we get there in a couple weeks, when it talks about how their teeth were as the teeth of lions, that comes straight out of the book of Joel. Remember where the locusts, the real literal locusts that were a plague on the land of Egypt? In Joel, it says that they had teeth like lions. That's a symbolic picture of what these locusts were like. What was it in Joel? What is that picture of? If there are locusts that have teeth like lions, what is that a picture of for us in Joel? That they're devastating. That they eat everything in sight, like our dog, right? She'll eat anything and everything in sight. That's what these locusts were meant to do. They have teeth like lions, and they're just going to devour anything in their path. And so we have here, right from the book of Joel, a symbolic picture of the devastating consequences of these locusts that are going to plague this earth. So again, I think it's clear that when there are clues in the text that show something different between a normal, natural understanding and something that is more symbolic or spiritual, you know, you have to kind of go that way. But I think also here we have clues that there is something being described between these two stars that are mentioned in these two trumpet judgments. So even though the third and the fifth trumpets mention a star that in some sense has been, or in some sense has fallen, there are enough differences to indicate that they don't necessarily have to be understood the same way. They're not, you don't have to be consistent on them in that one, they're both spiritual or they're both literal. Some of those differences can be worth mentioning. Even though these are not always seen in our English translations, the stars in both of these trumpet judgments are described differently in the underlying Greek. For example, there in chapter 8, verse 10, a direct translation reveals that this star, chapter 8, verse 10, fell from heaven. So this star fell from heaven. So you would have the star, the great star, which is the subject, and then you have the verb fell, and it fell from heaven. So it's a little different than the King James, how we have it there, and that's a normal thing for translations. But ultimately, this star that fell from heaven is really seen by John as it's making its descent, burning as a lamp. So what is heaven here? It's more like a backdrop for the scene of a star that is falling to this world, and it can simply describe the night sky. Heaven is not always talking about God's throne in Revelation. Sometimes it's referring just to the night sky or just the sky around us. And so that's another indication where, you know, we have just a backdrop here for chapter 8, verse 10. But then if you look at chapter 9, verse 1, we're told that John saw a star out of heaven having fallen. So again, in the literal, it'd be, the subject is star, and it says, instead of from heaven later, it would be a star from heaven fall to the earth. So really, what we have here is heaven is not just the backdrop for the star, it's the very place of the origin of the star. It's the star from heaven. And even the verb for fall is a little different. The one that John saw was as it's falling, whereas here, John doesn't see it fall. He sees the star as if it's already fallen on earth. It's called a perfect tense. So he sees it here on earth. He doesn't see it come down like in chapter 8, verse 10. He sees it here on earth already. So this star had already fallen to the earth when John saw it. So there's some difference already in just looking at the natural word and the natural orders of the word to show that there's something different going on. It doesn't have to mean the same thing. And I don't have to be called inconsistent by looking at them in different ways. There are enough differences that can indicate that these two stars don't have to be taken the same way. But when you look at the context of both the third trumpet judgment and the fifth trumpet judgment, I think it gets even clearer Because the star of the third trumpet can be understood in natural terms. You know, we described how even comets could display the same characteristic of this falling star from heaven against the backdrop of a night sky. But here in the fifth trumpet, in chapter 9, verse 1, it cannot be natural because of what we see going on, right? We see going on where this star is actually given something to be used, a key. So this is one of those times in Revelation, in chapter 9, verse 1, where star is used in a symbolic way. Different than the third trumpet, and it refers to a spiritual being that experienced some kind of fall into this world. It's here in this vision. It's here in this world. Now, keep your finger here and go with me to chapter 12, because I think the closest reference to what we find going on in chapter 9, verse 1, where John sees a star from heaven having fallen into the earth, we find a reference in chapter 12, verse 9. Now, chapter 12 is just full of symbolism, okay? There's a lot, and it's very clear that it's very symbolic. But in chapter 12, verse 9, we read about a great dragon. Now, this great dragon, who does he represent? Hopefully you already know. The devil, right? Because he's called that old serpent, verse 9, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. And look what happened to him. In the vision of chapter 12, at this moment, he was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. I think the counterpart of chapter 12 is what we find here in chapter 9, verse 1, where chapter 12, John sees this dragon being cast out to the earth, and what does John see here in chapter 9, verse 1? A star that has already fallen into this world. The star here is the devil. And this casting out of the devil is something that Jesus himself said would take place in his own life and ministry. In Luke chapter 10, verse 18, he says, "I beheld Satan as lightning falling from heaven." So even when Jesus was in this world, he had power over the devil, he had power over the demons, and he saw in his own vision the devil coming down straight from heaven into this world, because the devil has no place in heaven anymore, because of what Jesus had done for us in this world. So the fall of this star in chapter 9, verse 1, does not refer to the original fall of the devil. It's not talking about when he fell and took his angels with him initially. Many believe that it was a third of the good angels became bad angels by following after the devil. Instead, the fall here of chapter 9, verse 1, refers to the victory of Jesus over the devil through his life and death and resurrection for his people. Because if you remember, even after the devil became the devil, he had access to heaven. In the book of Job, we learn that in the days of Job, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, so sort of a reporting session, and we read that Satan also came among them. So even during the time of Job, Satan was able to access heaven and to accuse God's people before God himself. And that took place probably more often than we think. It certainly is pictured here in the book of Job, but it probably happened more times than we often think. But when Jesus ascended into heaven, after all of his life and his death and his resurrection, and now he's in heaven, what happened? The devil was cast back into this earth, never to broach the gates of heaven again. He was banished. And so I would take this going on here to refer to the devil as this fallen star who is finally cast out of heaven when Jesus ascended there in victory, so that when John sees him here, he has fallen. Jesus said, "I see Satan falling," and here Satan has fallen. He's already there, perfect tense. And now, where is the domain of the devil? In Ephesians 2:2, he's described as the prince of the power of the air. He's in this world, and he's the king of this world in some matter of respect. So I believe this fallen star, not falling star, but fallen star, is the devil himself. And God is still in control of him. Now, there have been others who see this fallen star as referring to another powerful angel, maybe not the devil, and that's okay. But because of the authority that he is given here in chapter 9, as well as the connection with chapter 12, I think it's better to see this fallen star as the devil, as the dragon, as the serpent himself. Because he has roamed to and fro in this earth all throughout the church age. And he's been waiting for this moment to come. You don't need to turn there, but in chapter 12, verse 12, it says, "Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he hath but a short time." And I think the woe of chapter 12 can be connected to the woes here of chapter 9. Because now the devil knows that his time is short, and he's going to do everything he possibly can to take as many people with him as he goes to the lake of fire. So again, there's this hint between the woe judgments and the woe of the banishment of the devil to the world in chapter 12. So keep that in mind as we move forward to chapter 12. So this is the first component of that first or that fifth trumpet judgment, this fallen star. But then we come to the second component. What is he given? To him was given what? A key. So here's the second component. First one is a fallen star, I believe referring to the devil. Second component, he's given a key. Now, before we look at what this key is for, we need to remember that whenever you find the phrase "was given," you see that again? This is another thing that we see frequently throughout the book of Revelation. "Was given," if you find that phrase and you're not told who gave it, it is considered a divine passive. A divine passive. That simply means God is the one who gives it. So God is the one who gave this key to this star, which shows us again that God is in complete control of everything that's going to happen into this world, right? He always has been, he always will be. And in particular, it is God the Son who gave the devil this key. If you remember all the way back in chapter 1, verse 18, Jesus himself tells John, "I am he that liveth and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore, amen, and I have the keys of what? Of hell and death." And what is this key for? Certainly the very pits of hell that we're going to see here, this bottomless pit that we'll look at here in a short while. So this means, again, that nothing happens in Revelation that is out of the Lord's hands. Instead, all of God's people can take comfort that he, Jesus, is always in control. And for his purposes, in his timing, he will even give the devil this key to the bottomless pit, even to fulfill his judgments in this world. So according to his own plan, according to his own purpose, according to his own time, under the fifth trumpet, he will lend his key to this fallen star. And remember, this key is only lent to the devil, to be used by the devil for one specific thing. This key does not belong to the devil. In fact, later on, all the way in chapter 20, we actually find this key again. In chapter 20, verses 1 and 2, we will find that the key that is given to the devil here is going to be used on the devil. Remember what happens? In Revelation 21, it says, "An angel came down from heaven." This is a good angel, by the way. "An angel came down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit." So obviously at some point between here in chapter 9 and chapter 20, the key goes back to heaven. And the key goes back to the possessor of that key, Jesus himself. And this angel comes down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit, a great chain in his hand, and he lays hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and he bounds him for 1,000 years. And so he can't deceive the nations. Now, what is the devil doing today? He's deceiving the nations. How many of the nations are very much deceived? And so I would take these 1,000 years not to be the present church age, but rather something yet to come. But at this time, that same key is just lent to the devil so that he can use it to open up what? The third component, which is, quite simply, the bottomless pit, right? The bottomless pit. Now, this is how several versions translate two Greek words that I have there on your lesson guide. The first word is phrear, which is just a word that means a pit or a well. If you go to John chapter 4, 11 and 12, it talks about Jacob's well. It's Jacob's phrear. It's Jacob's pit. And so, again, we have a picture already in mind. We had a well issue in the last couple of years, right? And hopefully we're able to get that remedied and fixed. So you can think of a well. You think of a shaft that is is dug through the earth so that you can get down to the bottom of things, right? Well, then the second word is abusus, from which we get our English word abyss, right? And abyss simply means a place without a bottom. It's not really something that is something we could picture. But hopefully this gives you a little bit of an idea. It's actually, abusus is a combination of two words, all right? The first word is ah, which when it's placed in front of a Greek word, negates it, all right? So it's kind of like what we would do with in. So if you are sincere, that means you're honest, you're being forthright. But if you're insincere, it's the exact opposite, right? Well, that's what happens with an ah in Greek. So the word bouthos really has the idea of the sea. We get the word bath from, all right? So imagine you taking a step into your full bathtub, all right? And as soon as you put your foot in there, there's no bottom to it. There's a ah bouthos, there's a abyss, right? And instead of, you know, just kind of enjoying and relaxing in the hot water of the bathtub, you just keep going down, 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 down until you drown, right? Well, that's what the abyss here is. So the abyss, or the opposite of a bath, the opposite of the sea, describes a place that's even lower than the sea, even what is described as the underworld. So that is what we have here. Two words, phrear, abusus, the bottomless pit, or the well without a bottom. This is something that is described in the Old Testament in different ways and at different times. One writer says that the abyss in the Old Testament is synonymous with the concept of Hades. And so a lot of times when you find Hades in some English translations or hell in other English translations, it's a translation of the underworld, the place for the departed dead. And not just dead humans, but even the dead spirits of the underworld, the demons that fell with the devil. Abyss is Hades. And so the very pit of Hades, or the very pit of this abyss, is a place that is described in the Old Testament as a place where even fallen angels are imprisoned. Listen to these verses from Isaiah 24. It says, "It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and they shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit, and shall be shut up in the prison, and after many days shall they be visited." So this is even a prophecy in Isaiah where God himself is going to arrest spiritual fallen beings, demons, devils, and throw them into a pit, a prison of a pit. And yet, after many days, they will be visited. That is, many days they will be released and ultimately judged. So in a very real sense, the place that we think about hell as being the place where unbelievers die and their souls go there is also a place where many demons are presently. There are also demons that roam the earth. But there are demons that are in this bottomless pit, this abyss, because they're waiting and they're reserved for the time when they will be released from that pit by the devil himself. Now, this phrase, bottomless pit, can also be translated a couple of other ways. It can be translated the pit of the abyss, which can either mean the shaft of the abyss. So, again, you can think of our well, okay? You think of a well that's drilled all the way straight down, and then right below that would be the abyss, okay? That's one way that you can picture it. And so you can picture how the devil would come and you know, if there's a door or a gate over that, he would unlock that, and they would come from the nether regions of the underworld and flow back through that pit out into this world in a spiritual way. Another way of looking at it is that below the abyss, there's a pit. The language can actually be the same way. So you've got the underworld, you got hell itself, and then in hell, there's a deeper pit that is bore and dug that is reserved for these demonic angels, these demonic beings. It can actually refer to a deeper and darker place than the abyss itself. Personally, that's how I take it. because I think that this pit of the abyss could be a prison for the devils, just like the abyss itself, hell, is the prison for the dead who die apart from Christ. But you can look at it either way. I just think that there is a place in the underworld where there are demons that God has not let roam the earth. He has imprisoned them for a reason, for a time, for a purpose. And at that time, here in chapter 9, verse 1, the devil will release them under God's permission for God's plan. But either way, this abyss became known as the place of evil spirits, whether they're the spirits of fallen men or fallen angels. In fact, it's the very place that some demons asked Jesus to send them. I remember when Jesus cast out some demons out of a man that is known as the Gadarene demoniac in Luke 8:31. And Jesus asked them their name, and they replied, "Our name is Legion, for we are many." And it says that they besought him, these demons besought Jesus, that he would not command them to go out into the deep. Now, when we think of deep, we think of water, but the word there is abyss. They didn't want to go to the pit of the abyss. They didn't want to be imprisoned with the other demonic angels that are down there. And so they ask and beg Jesus not to send them, but where does Jesus send them instead? Into a herd of swine that runs headlong into the sea. And more than likely, they're imprisoned there, even to this day. So we will find this same bottomless pit later on. We find it in chapter 11. It's where the beast will ascend from. And then again later on in chapter 20, it's where the devil will then be confined for 1,000 years. So those are the three main components of this fifth trumpet judgment. Now, we'll look at the consequences starting next Sunday after this fallen star takes the key in order to open the pit and release and wreak havoc on the world of men, starting there in verse 2. And we'll learn more about that starting next Sunday.